everybody, and welcome into episode 4 of the Good Take podcast. I'm Alex Sutton, joined by Zevin Schuster as always, and today we have a very special guest, an MLB player for 9 seasons with the Expos and the Giants, coached with the White Sox for a little while, and he's here to talk to us about the MLB season starting up and everything surrounding that. Wallace Johnson is on the program, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, guys.
Oh, I was going to say, I really like that chair, too. It's really cool.
I'm trying to be informal, guys. So let me, yeah.
That is the vibe we like to, like, you know. This is not like wear a suit on, like, a TV desk, you know. It's just very, like, how was quarantine? I know we were talking the other day, and, you know, you haven't really been able to travel. You haven't been able to do your, like, camps. How have you, like, adjusted to, like, you know, this crazy time?
Yes, it's definitely crazy times. I live a lifestyle pretty much of self-quarantine anyway. I don't get out much, but this is a little overdoing it. But yeah, traveling, you know, I'm always going to Florida and Canada, and those two places are off limits. So yeah, I'm just trying to hang in there as everyone else is.
Yeah, so then when you first saw the baseball season sort of finally get on track, I guess, what was your first reaction? Like, why do you think it took so long? Who was sort of more at fault? Like, how do you think that whole thing came together? Like, why was it such a long process, do you think?
Well, baseball's big business, and I believe business allows this stuff to happen. I wouldn't say anyone's at fault. You know, the owners are the owners. The owners will always be the owners. So I think the Players Association is definitely the strongest of all unions in professional sports. So they're used to this type of tactics by the owners. So who's going to yell chicken first, or who's going to give up first? But I wouldn't put any directly fault. You know, probably both are not faultless. But I also believe that the owners have always been kind of hardline anyway.
Okay. Now, it actually leads me into my next question then. I was going to ask, because, you know, players like Max Scherzer were very vocal about, you know, not giving an inch because their salaries are already going to be compromised because the season was going to be short anyways. I guess you could argue the players could have been a little more compromising. But yeah, I was just going to ask then, like, who – it's like the typical millionaires versus billionaires type thing. Like, who – like, which side were you on? You know, you were involved in, I believe, 2 or 3 various work stoppages in your career. So whose side are you typically on with these types of things?
I definitely have to say the players, even though I was in management, i.e. coaching. But coming up through the 80s, you know, we had the work stoppages, and we understood standing our ground because we felt that the owners were not on the up and up. That's something that always, like, been on my mind, that when you come to the negotiating table, it's like everyone's fair until they're not. So I would say I lean more toward the players, and I understand their stand. And like I said, history always repeats itself, because I was still part of that collusion era in the 80s that the owners were colluding salaries, you know, getting together not to pay people not to pay those guys salaries, and, you know, Andre Dawson giving the Cubs a blank check to sign, you know, one of the best players in the league. And so that's where my whole experience base comes from with dealing with the owners. But I'm pretty sure that there's fault on both sides, but I always say the owners are always more at fault. How's that?
All right.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. So you mentioned the 3 stoppages. Obviously, there was the strike in 81, which split the season in 2, and then a strike in 85 and a lockout in 1990. Are there any parallels between those stoppages which happened during your playing career and what happened this season?
It's totally different in the degree that no one could predict the coronavirus coming in. I know the collective bargaining agreement was about to expire too. So I think there's apples and oranges, but still there's some type of connection in that both sides not agree and the season may suffer, but in the long term, they'll come together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And as fans and analysts, one thing I've noticed is that Zether and I, you know, we can offer our own opinions based on our knowledge of the situation, based on what we've heard and read and all that stuff, but that it doesn't really compare, you know, being up close and personal with the experience of labor negotiators the way that the players and the owners are. So my question off of that for you is, what is something about the players' union or its relationship with the league that the average fan might not know?
The union is very strong. The players usually have always stuck together. And that's probably one of the most important things of a labor strike, if the players stick together. And, you know, we've had great, you know, leadership along the lines that they explained to us, the players, what was going on, what was happening, what to expect. And we were always able to, like, you know, put aside our salaries or save some of our salaries in case there was a work stoppage. So we knew this years ahead of time that this may happen. So prepare yourself for it. And like I said, I believe the Players Association was very good is always explaining that to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And now, I mean, it looked like when all the negotiations were happening, the counteroffers were being made back and forth, that the players were definitely kind of overwhelmingly voting against them each time. You know, the vote, it wasn't like it was a close split or anything. And now there is going to be a season, you know, there's going to be these testing protocols in place. The league says they have a plan for when players test positive, or if they do. There's going to be some limited travel, you know, within the regions of, based on divisions and things like that. Based on what you know about sort of the current plan, would you want to play under the current circumstances?
Good question. It depends on my personal environment, I guess. If I had a family and I was concerned about them and that type of thing, I may be more hesitant. But if I know that, I'm here and it's about me trying to get my money, then perhaps I would be more adventurous. But I know these are no matter the protocols put in place, it doesn't mean that it's going to be safety all around. Something is sure to happen. But once again, it depends on the individual player's feelings. So that's a very tough question. So just like the NBA, it's a tough question. So it depends on your personal situation.
And so I think a really interesting angle to approach this was because, like, going into the year with all everything going on, like with the Astros, you know, baseball was getting so much publicity. It was getting so much, you know, there was all this talk. You had the Astros and players from other teams like taking shots at each other, like through the media. Like, I think the interest in baseball this year in the regular season, like, just would have been the highest it's been in years. And it was kind of building. You would have had the Astros. Fans would have booed them like the whole season. I know my dad was going to the second series of the season for the A's against the Astros, and he was ready to just like go off, you know. And now this kind of the whole kind of all that kind of momentum. You know, the saying is like, you know, it's better to have bad publicity than no publicity, and like all that momentum kind of died down. Do you see? I don't know. Can baseball like ever like recapture the sort of like momentum that they had, or do you think the season? Do you think that they just failed? There was just a big failure to capitalize on this sort of momentum, and how damaging do you think like all the that kind of effect will be like long term?
Well, baseball has been around over a century, and there's always been stuff that happens, and I believe that it would recover. I think the whole I totally agree with the whole Astros, you know, bringing more attention to the game kind of thing. But baseball has survived. We may not recognize this as the game we saw years ago, but baseball will survive. And, you know, after the 94 strike, you know, no one felt that, you know, people would come back to the game. And you had Cal Ripken, you know, basically with his streak. And then you also had the McGuire and Sosa situation. So things always happen, but then stuff also brings it back. So, yeah, I'm not a pessimist, but it's going to be a tough haul. It's going to be a tough haul because we live in uncertain times now, and nothing's really predictable. But I do believe that the game will come back at some form of time, and fans will, you know, gravitate toward in due time.
Yeah. Wait, just to quickly, just interject one thing. Would you be really, like, how mad would you be if you were, like, on a, let's say, like, the Yankees or, like, the Dodgers who lost to the Astros in 27? Like, would you be, how slighted would you feel?
I'd be pretty pissed, to be honest with you, because that's, you know, there's always, baseball, there's always been some type of sign, you know, you get a sign from the guy at second base to let you know the location of a pitch and stuff like that. Always been part of the game. It was up to the pitcher and catcher to, like, change the sign. But what the Astros did was, like, so it just basically just took it to a whole nother level. And knowing how hard it is to hit a baseball and see how confident the Astros were hitting the ball with two strikes, always in the back of my mind. So I wasn't that surprised to find out that, you know, they had the aid of hitting the garbage can or something like that. But yeah, I'd be extremely pissed because you want to be on the same level. You know, talent is like, you know, you're playing against the best. You want to compete at the same level with the same rules. And when people take advantage of that, you know, you do feel some type of way.
Got out there.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes sense. And, you know, before the season, players on teams like the Yankees and the Dodgers were talking about, you know, how excited they were to get out there against the Astros and play those teams so they could go out and beat them and really take it to them. Sort of on a related note to that, were there ever any teams or players that, like, where the game just felt more meaningful to you for some reason that you just love going out to play because you wanted to beat them so badly?
I would say there were a few teams. I guess growing up in Gary, Indiana, you know, the Cubs were on our local TV. So coming back to play in Chicago, I was around a lot of friends and family. So that was always a spot I wanted to do well in. And also the Dodger Stadium, I always had a lot of friends out there too. So those are the two places I think of that I really want to go out and do well. I never did like the Cardinals. They were so good in the 80s and so competitive, but I love to compete against them.
It's now, just to shift gears just a little bit, what are your sort of thoughts on sort of what's gone on, you know, just in the country the last few weeks? And then I don't know if there's any personal experiences that, you know, stand out to you both in and out of baseball. How do you sort of view sort of even this, the whole conversation on race, how we've evolved, how we haven't evolved enough? And then, you know, has... How could baseball do a better job? Trying to make it as broad for you, so you can take it wherever you like.
Growing up in the 60s, I had a chance to, you know, I was a young guy, but there was a lot of strife during the 60s. And as a young guy, you didn't know all the particulars, but you knew there was upheavals and things happened socially. Comparatively speaking, it kind of reminds me of today. And that you got the young folks out here doing stuff. It's not the parents or the grandparents. It's the young kids who have made up their own mind that, you know, something is wrong, and then they're showing their action. So as far as baseball, I think they got a long way to go if they want to bring back African American players. I know they have programs in place, but I believe it's a mindset that needs to be determined that, hey, we want to, like, really be inclusive and not just one or two. You know, as in, they have these academies all around the Dominican Republic and places like that where they get a bunch of guys where they can pick from. Well, it's not the case here. We have selective, I guess you call it, tours of, what's the word? These showcases. And to me, in my opinion, is that, yes, showcases may show you top players, but there's always players that, you know, are late bloomers that you miss on because you're looking at the top players. And I don't think baseball has ever really address that completely. So in summation, I think that, you know, baseball, it's a different type of sport from basketball and football. But I think that with the history of it, you know, you get the whole, in my opinion, the whole when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier and Larry Doby on the American League side, that once these things happened, our society as a whole got better. But once again, I think baseball has dropped the ball now, and that they didn't forget that history and realize that when there's more inclusion, especially, you know, African Americans, that the game will grow bigger and even more popular, I believe. So, but, you know, basketball has stolen the spotlight. You know, all the urban guys want to play basketball when I'm growing up. But still, we played more than one sport growing up, which meant that, you know, no one had, like, you only could play one sport. It was like you play more than one sport and you're already better in the other, in your best sport. So if I played baseball, and let's say I played tennis, well, I'm going to play tennis to improve our baseball skills. But the mindset of society is that, no, you're going to play one sport. And to me, that's always been like a disservice to the kids.
So now, could you ever, I was going to say, well, first, I don't know, were you a good hoops player? I don't know, what sport did you play then when you?
Oh, I was a good tennis player.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, because I was a switch hitter, which meant that, you know, I hit from both sides.
Oh, yeah.
I had a natural backhand, which a lot of guys at that point in time didn't have. Backhand was always tough for them, but for me, it was
my backhand is awful. It's
but yeah, yes, yeah, so tennis was my sport. That to me, it elevated my whole baseball game because all of a sudden it's eye to hand coordination, footwork, and stuff like that. So
similar motion.
Yeah. So just to sort of expand on that sort of last topic just a little bit more. Like, could you ever tell the difference between, I don't know, like regular booing and, you know, regular like road fan just like heckling, like boo, like you suck, like all that type of stuff, versus like, I don't know, I don't know where the line is, because again, Alexander and I, like, we've never obviously played, and you know, could you ever tell the difference between maybe something maybe racially insensitive versus just like regular fans just being fans?
Specifically as a player, I mean, playing the game, one of my strengths was to focus, and that, you know, I enjoy going into the enemy territory and having success. Because the best success you can have is shutting them up. And so by being successful, you shut them up. So no, I didn't hear any individual, it was just a collective, you know, boo or something like that. But I don't remember any racial epithets being thrown my way. But yeah, it was just the whole us against them kind of mindset, and it just gave me greater inner strength. I think that, you know, people be booing, and really, you know, cheering for their team, but also hoping that you make, you know, you mess up or make an out or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask about like sort of a similar question, something sort of along the same lines, which is, you know, with some sports and some leagues coming back, you know, there have been players questioning whether right now is a good time, whether it's a good idea to return to sports right now. What role do you think sports plays in bringing people together and moving society forward versus the risk that it's going to distract from issues?
Well, I think sports in general are a distraction for the American folks, because it gets you away from your workplace and things are happening, and gives you a place to relax and let yourself go. So sports is an integral part of our society. I think that if we were just concentrating totally on the virus and woe is us, then, you know, not having an outlet like sports will even make us a more negative, I guess, situation. But I think sports has its way of just helping folks forget about the real world at that time, and it allows them a place to breathe, I guess, a place to open up and relax and enjoy entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think sports are really important to society, because it's something that has the potential to be so unifying and so
so fun.
Great to bring people it's a way for just people to have fun, come together over this common thing, you know, everything else aside, it brings people together. So, all right, we're going to shift gears once again and switch to just a few more sort of fun questions about your career and your experiences with the game, or, right? Are we good to go with that? All right, so just kicking things off, you were one of the league's best pinch hitters during your playing career. What did you find were the keys to being a good pinch hitter?
For me, it was basically using all the skills that I had accrued over my lifetime. That was like having a good batting eye, being patient, and basically waiting for that one opportunity. Because pinch hitting, you only have basically one opportunity to do this. So you had to really concentrate, and you knew that only time you pinch hit, it's like your team is losing in the eighth or ninth inning. And you're going against the closer of the other team, so you really had to like prepare yourself. So my whole little plan, in fact, was emulated by my teammates, is that the first three innings I'll sit on the bench, watch how they get the flow of the game, see how it's going kind of thing. And then the next two innings, I would just basically go to the tunnel, swing and ride the bicycle, stuff like that. And then the last two innings, I would wait for the call from the manager. That was my routine every day. So I was prepared for, like, you know, if I did get the call, I was going to be ready. I was going to be loose enough to beat out an infield hit, and I was going to be loose enough to, like, you know, make contact with the ball. So I think those things added in made me a pretty good pinch hitter during those times.
Nice, because I like that you mentioned that, because I sort of compare it to, like, you know, we're talking about basketball earlier, and, like, you know, someone has to come off the bench after, you know, sitting there for a while and just, you know, make a three or something. It just requires a lot of, like, mental discipline, physical discipline. Like, you just really, you know, as you guys like to say, it's like professionalism. It seems like today there's a lot more helicopter. It seems like there's a lot more people who want a bigger role and who want sort of, I don't know, they sort of maybe care more about their own, like, personal. Seems like they care more about, like, their personal brand. It's nothing I can do. Seems like they care more, like, about their personal brand, and their, you know, maybe their focus on winning isn't quite the same. I don't know. Do you think you're talking about, like, your focus? Do you think players today have that same kind of mindset, that same kind of, like, mentality of being professional, winning at all costs? Or do you think, I don't know, are their goals maybe a little more self-focused? What do you think?
I think you hit on a number of good points. I think any success I had in the major leagues was because I was mentally strong, mentally prepared. And that took a lot of patience to, like, study and get yourself ready. I grew up in a team-oriented organization. We were trying to win as a team. So if I did well as an individual and the team won, that was a perfect scenario. I think today it's like, you know, the society has got to where it's me. And what can I do for myself? And I'm not saying there wasn't guys like that back in the day, but it just seems more prominent now. What, you know, what brand am I going to, you know, this is my brand. And it kind of takes away from the team concept. So I've always, like, in my little coaching, I tell guys, like, play the scoreboard. In the sense that if you're behind, then perhaps you need to try to take pitches to get on base. You know, things like that, to where it's team-oriented. The bottom line is win the game. You can get four hits and lose, and you know, that doesn't improve the team on team focus kind of thing. But yeah, I totally agree with you. It's a mental aspect, but also it's a team oriented type of thing, that if we win, we all win. And I think being a component of that kind of mindset makes your team stronger. So the one thing I like about the Expos is that we had a strong bench. So even though the regulars may not have been able to, like, get to the point of winning, the bench was able to come through and get us through a lot of games. So to me, that was very, you know, as any other players in the major leagues, you always want to play. But, you know, once again, once you understand your role and you're good at it, then, you know, you're helping the team win also.
Nice. Now, I guess we're sort of talking a little bit about, you know, old school, new school, how things used to be, how things, like, are now. One thing I would love to get your opinion on is sort of the rise and the role of analytics. And, you know, things like pace of play, you know, there's been a lot of sort of adjustments to kind of how baseball is played and how, you know, how it's sort of being presented to not just its players, but also to the fans. Probably, I mean, we would assume to try and draw in more fans. I know there's been kind of not a consensus, but there's been an opinion out there that's, you know, they're too far in the past, and so they need to sort of, you know, stay with the current times. You know, a lot of people now have, like, short attention spans. What do you think about the rise of analytics, you know, the pace of play rules, you know, between innings? I know there was a quote from David Ortiz a couple years ago when he found out, like, oh, I can't, like, get out of the box and, like, spit in my hands. He was like, that's, like, bleeping bleep, you know, he was really mad. What are your thoughts on all the different ways the game has evolved, you know, on and off field? Like, do you like it, kind of? It just kind of is what it is. What do you think?
I have no problems with analytics. I think they're part of the whole process, but I also think the actual, that's one of my old managers that I played for, named Felipe Alou. He had this comment that he would say, either you can play or you can't play. So that was just a gut feeling of his that allowed him to like pick out players who could do well and that kind of thing that came from his experiences. I think that's mixed with analytics, then you have a better chance. If everything is just focused on analytics, numbers, 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 like, okay, well, this guy does this or we're going to do that, then I think that takes away the whole, you know, you can tell me my analytics at the end of the season. But during the season, it doesn't matter. It's, am I doing my role? Am I doing that? But I would hope that there's some kind of combination of player development and analytics coming together to make better decisions. As far as the pace of play, I think baseball, see, once again, it's a whole new society now.
Exactly.
Baseball is a sport that there's so many things can happen between pitches, and that you can sit there and that at 15, 20 seconds, you can, like, talk to your buddy and say, well, this can happen, why they didn't do this, and that, while the other games are, like, so quick paced. So baseball always had that traditional thing of, you know, you got a chance to, like, think through scenarios, what could possibly happen, who's in the bullpen, what this guy is going to do, that kind of thing. So if that is missing in the sense that when you try to fasten the pace because of the short attention span of the fans, you know, it doesn't bother me, but it's not too baseball in the sense that baseball is known to be slow. You know, and that slowness comes the greatness of the game. And if your mindset of like understanding the innuendos or the things that are happening in between pitches, or, you know, or innings, it's you know, I thought that was special about baseball.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Sort of on a related note to that, just something I'm curious about is, do you think there's an opportunity there for baseball to kind of lean into that and sort of as the more sort of the slow pace, the leisurely game that's all about, you know, strategy and carefully thinking everything over sort of before it happens?
I think that ship has sailed. I guess, you know, it was, again, it's different generations, it's different mindsets. I just think it is sale, but I hope that the history of it will be shown in its entirety, that where it came from, and that the little, like today I heard the whole, in extra innings, you start a hitter at second base, you know, a runner at second base.
Yeah.
Like, that's unfathomable. That's like, I can't, you know, you know, we're just trying to do too much now. It's like, just play the game. And obviously everybody's making money. So no matter if you don't want to call it the national pastime, still people are getting paid very well. Owners are making money. The players are, you know, are making their money. And, you know, to sometimes change, all change is not good change. So, but it's just interesting to see where it's at right now.
Do you think the winner of this World Series will have like an asterisk by it? I mean, because of all that's going on? Or I know personally, as an A's fan, I've been dying. I mean, Alexander's a Giants fan. He's won 3 World Series. I'm just trying to get one. And so I'll obviously be happy if they win, but I'll be a little bit worried that if they do win, that everyone's going to be like, oh, the A, like, doesn't count. It was half, like, wasn't even half a season. I don't know. Do you think, does the winner of this season, do they get the same credit, do you think, as, like, a quote-unquote regular year?
Well, in my experiences, yes, I would say they are champions. And because everyone's starting at the same starting line. And it reminds me of the 81 season where it was a split season. And everyone knows that the Dodgers won the World Series that year. And no one put an asterisk behind that. That was a split season. And no, I think that whoever wins, wins. And history will show that it was an unusual year where you only played 60 games. And that, you know, just due to the virus. But, you know, asterisks are overrated. Either you're a winner or a loser. If you're a champion, you're a champion. And we can always find scenarios of, well, if this had not happened or if that did not happen, if this player didn't play, that, you know, you can always find that reason. But the bottom line is who raised the trophy at the end, unless you're the Astros who cheated a lot. But that's a whole other story.
wait, so just really quick. Sorry, Alex. No, go the Astros, do you think they should have an asterisk next to their title? I just have to ask.
And the sad thing is that they're a very talented team.
They have a bunch of great players, like, no question.
So there was no reason to, like, take it to that level. But once again, that has happened in baseball before in the sense of sometimes they get, you know, the steroids or the PEDs kind of thing. But I wouldn't put an asterisk, but I would let people know that this was not within the fairness of the game winning kind of thing. You know, I wouldn't take away their trophy there, you know. But once again, I would have a – like, I'm not a big asterisk fan. Asterix fan, but I would let people know how, you know, they were, you know, how they won or perhaps how they won. And it's just like, you know, the deflate gate with the Patriots. It's like, still champions, but, you know, they had their little, you know, basically advantage that they use.
Yeah.
You can't take away the championship, though. But you just in the back of your mind know that, okay, well, you know, sometimes, you know, some people are luckier than others.
No, it's funny that you said that, because when we talked about that on a previous podcast, and when that was what we compared it to, like we compared the Astros to the Patriots. That was our we had the exact same comparison. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you were talking about the modern game right now. Sort of staying on that track. Who are your favorite players in the game today?
The shortstop for the White Sox, Anderson, who won the batting title last year.
Tim Anderson, yeah.
Right. I enjoy watching him play. And it hurts me because I really enjoyed seeing the little second baseman with the Astros and then the tall shortstop. I actually went to a game and saw them play, and I really was impressed with their ability. And now because of the old cloud that is covering them, but yeah, I like the way they play the game. Who else? You know, I'm not a big fan of sluggers. Because either they're going to strike out or hit a home run. So, you know, the Judges and the Stanton, you know, guys like that. But those are the guys that I'm familiar with that, you know, that come to mind, that if I'm walking past the TV and I hear their name, I will stop and watch the game. So,
Does anyone like remind you of you from today's game? Or? Are you going to say like Mike Trout or something? Just, you know.
No, not quite. The little shortstop that was with the Yankees, I think I think he left a free agency.
Gregorius?
Right. I like his style of play. I thought that, you know, even though he wasn't a switch hitter, I like his patience at the plate. I like the way he played the game, and I enjoyed his baseball instinct. That's the one that comes to mind that, you know, I could like say, okay, that reminds me a little bit of my game.
And sorry, just one more question. Was there a toughest pitcher and a toughest pitch that you faced in your career? Toughest pitcher, and then so it doesn't have to be from the same. Like someone else could have had a tougher pitch, like one pitch. But who was the toughest pitcher, and who threw the toughest pitch for you to hit in your career?
For me, you know, being the hitter I was, I always get myself out, in my opinion. So
all right.
but as a young player coming up, there was a guy named Bruce Sutter who had the split finger fastball or split fingers, and like it made me grow as a player to understand that if I took that first pitch was a fastball down the plate, that was gonna be the last fastball I would see. All of a sudden, the split finger where you couldn't hit when you was in trouble. So that made me a better pinch hitter, because as I got older, I understood that when they tried to get over with that easy over fastball, I had to be ready to hit it. That's why I think I had my success. But I would say Bruce Sutter was my toughest pitcher, but I was a young guy then. And that split finger is the one that, you know, got me that at that time. Paul Osemacher was a left-handed pitcher with the Cubs. And he had this cutter that, because, you know, switch hitting right-handed, it's like it would get into your hands. You know, it's like a left-handed Mariano Rivera kind of thing, to where, you know, you're going to hit it or it's going to break your bat. But that was tough. That was tough. But I believe that, in my opinion, that if I'd have played or hit more on the right side, I'd have made that adjustment. But those are two guys that come to mind. You know, I kind of feel, you know, Todd Worrell used to throw very hard. He's with the St. Louis Cardinals, and that was always a challenge. But him and Alejandro Pena, you know, they threw very hard. But as a hitter, you're not backing down. So to answer your question, they're all tough. And but you make adjustments on the pitches, on the type of pitches they make, and that comes from the mental aspect of knowing what they like to throw in certain situations and be prepared for it. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but
do it.
But yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. No, I love it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, one of your biggest claims to fame is that Ron Robinson took a perfect game, two outs in the ninth. You faced him as what would have been the last batter's perfect game. Got a full count, hit two strikes. Yep. Hit a single to break it up. My question for that, something I've been curious about, is have you interacted with Ron Robinson since that day?
The next day, going back to the stadium, going back to work, we walked past each other going to, through the tunnel. And we kind of just, you know, spoke, but it wasn't like, you know, any conversation. But it wasn't uncomfortable for me. But I can't read his mind. But occasionally, your fans will say that he, whenever they meet Brian Robinson, they bring it up. So I'm pretty sure that, you know, I'm emblazoned on his mind that, yeah, I broke up his perfect game. And unfortunately, it's like, it's an amazing thing. I can always remember that one because as Pascal Perez was pitching that day, and he's pitching a very good game. And I'm sitting waiting, and I did my little pitch hitting routine to get ready. And I can just see that, you know, everybody was getting out. And I just had a feeling that I was going to pinch hit at that time. So I walked up, and this brings up the whole total of the fans. So the fans at Riverfront Stadium were all standing on their feet, you know, cheering for this guy that the opposing, well, the Reds all had their valley hats on, turned around. And, you know, so it was like a great moment for where, you know, I was ready for it in the sense that, you know, I worked the count. Well, once again, being a contact hitter, I didn't strike out much, but ready to work the count and then able to get a hit and just deflate that whole stadium was a wonderful thing. But you know, that gets back to like, yeah, I outside of that next day walking through the tunnels going different directions, you know, I meet Ron, but there was no conversations about it. But like I said, folks have always, you know, ask him about me. I saw Ron Robinson, and you know, I asked him about that. You know, he just says, "Oh, well, you know, thought of this, thought of that." But yeah, that's that whole scenario of the Ron Robinson perfect game. So that was a highlight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, if you guys had beers today, who would buy? Do you think would he be like a congratulatory? Would you be like sympathetic? Like who would buy each other a beer? Who do you think? Who would pay for beers?
Well, I don't like pitchers anyway, so I wouldn't buy a beer. I'm sorry, this doesn't happen. Yeah, me and pitchers didn't get along, but I would definitely, you know, shake his hand and thank him for making my one of my best things of my career. So
nice. Just as you sort of wrap up, do you have any other favorite moments from your career? Any you know, favorite highlights of yours? You know, what do you sort of hold dear?
Before I became a professional, I played at Indiana State, and I was down, it was at the same time that we had Larry Bird was there and Kirk Thomas was there. So it was a great time in Terre Haute.
Larry legend.
One of the highlights was that our last regular season game before the Missouri Valley Conference tournament, Larry Bird played for first base for us. And so that was a big thing. Larry Bird played baseball for us that one game because he was bugging our coach, I guess, teaching one of his classes. So Larry Bird actually played. That was the highlight of my collegiate career, and that before we won the championship, the conference championship. But you know, having Larry out there playing, that was a sight to see. In fact, that was our biggest crowd of our successful season was that Sunday. But moving on to professionally, I was really blessed to play in the Expos organization. They were very talented. They had a lot of great players, young players, and the cities we played in were always great. Jamestown, New York, West Palm Beach, Florida, Memphis, Tennessee, and Denver, Colorado. So having a chance to go through that pretty much evolved, in my opinion, evolved me as a person and as a player. But then getting a chance to get a call up after winning the 81 Championship American Association in Denver, getting a chance to, you know, be in the major leagues with, you know, guys like, you know, Gary Carter, Andre Dawson, Tim Raines, all these guys that, you know, they were battling for that second half season championship, and I had an opportunity to pinch hit, like in the sixth inning, I believe, that we pretty much, I think that the Expos had, the prior 2 years came close to winning, but they lost. 1 year was to the Phillies, 1 year was to the Pirates. So this was a year that, you know, the Expos were really trying to get into the playoffs, and I had an opportunity to, like, pinch hit, and I hit a two-run triple.
Nice.
It ended up being the winning runs, and therefore that basically started my major league career. So I could do no wrong at that point in time. Those are my highlights of
nice, of
playing baseball, yeah, college and professional. And yeah, it's been a great run and learned a lot of great people. And definitely there's no regrets on how my career turned out.
Absolutely. Awesome. Yeah, that's all we've got for questions on our end. Thank you so much for joining us today. One last thing. Is there anything you want to plug or anything you want to tell us about that you got going on?
I'm the executive director of North Shore Amateur Sports Academy here in Gary, Indiana. And basically we try to teach coaches on different things that can, you know, be better coaches and activate the youth to play different sports, not just baseball. We try to introduce them to the non-traditional sports, whether it was tennis, hockey, things of this nature, track and field, to where we get the kids there and let them play different sports they never played before. And it's been pretty successful. But yeah, that's NorthShoreAcademy.org. That's, you know, we were part of trying to make a difference. And thank you guys for having me on the podcast, my first podcast.
Yeah, awesome.
If I ever get another one, I'll do much better. But thank you for
now. You were awesome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and thank you for your
patience. This is a blast. This was awesome.
Yeah.
Good seeing you guys, man. You can get good luck in school and keep doing what you're doing, and look forward to seeing you on your own ESPN network.
Oh man, yeah. You won't flip the channel. You won't. You know, it's like, oh my god.
I'll actually make sure you're on Netflix. So, you know, I ain't got to worry about my commercials. But definitely, guys, thanks again.
Absolutely.
Thank you, man.
Thank you, Wally. Thank you so much.
All right, guys. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Bye.